You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Thursday, getting through the last couple days of March. Joining me from the Washington, D.C. area, Bob Nielsen. Nielsen, what's going on? How are you?
I'm sitting here 60 miles from Walter Reed, looking forward to our discussion.
What is, do you live 60 miles from Walter Reed?
Yeah, I live 60 miles. I live across the Bay Bridge, across from Annapolis on the Eastern Shore.
Oh, you live
a bit of a jaunt when I go in there.
Now, I've heard the major criticism of living in Annapolis is access. Yes, no?
Oh, Annapolis, particularly in the summertime when all the visitors come, it's a tough town to get around. I used to live in Annapolis, and frankly, during the summer, we wouldn't even bother to go downtown.
It's
a great town.
It's a beautiful place, though. I mean, there's a reason why it's crowded. And it's not because it's a dump, okay? That's
there's a few sailors floating around.
Yeah, but they can't even afford to hang out there. There's a lot of very wealthy people that like Annapolis, and it's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful place. Now,
when you think about it, in the 50s, Annapolis was in the dumps.
Well, we know it still is, but they like it. What about, so you're born and raised where, though? You're a New York guy, right?
Long Island. New York. Outlaw beer.
What's the best part
about it?
Exactly.
Forget about it. I'm from New York.
What's the best part about living in New York?
Best part is having been from there. I grew up in New York, and I went to college upstate New York, and then went in the Marine Corps and bounced all around. When my wife and I got married, we lived on Long Island, and we finally, in 1980, got transferred to San Francisco with Turner. And one of the great things was finally getting away from New York, and now when I go back, my blood pressure goes up about 15 points.
Why?
Traffic, people, obnoxious.
I love that place. I mean,
as long as I'm visiting,
there. I will tell you this: I don't think there's a more fun city to go to in the world, and let me tell you why. Whoever the geniuses were that came up with the idea of a subway in 1905, or whenever the hell they designed it, that person, in terms of being long-range genius, is up there with Theodore Roosevelt in terms of seeing well beyond the horizon.
And Central Park.
Oh, my God.
Central Park.
Yeah, I mean.
And New York still is the best place in the world to eat, in my opinion.
Well, what makes it so much fun is you don't need a car. You get up and you hop on the subway. You can get around anywhere in Manhattan. You could even go to Long Island if you want to. Now, I don't know why you'd want to go out there, but if you want to, you can get there, right? You get on the Long Island Railroad.
You can only afford to live on Long Island. You can't afford to live in Manhattan.
you're right about that. You're right about that. But you know what? It is such a fun. It's a city with its own vibe. It's got incredible history. The sports there are awesome. But you can get around, and there's this incredible food everywhere you go. It's if you've never been,
and it's alive 24 hours a day.
Oh my God! And if there's ever anything going on and you're down in Times Square and all that, it's a hoot. It's an absolute hoot. And there's, between the museums and everything else, tons of history and stuff to see. But a fun, fun place. And I said, the best part is not having a car. You just go.
Yeah, and we've built a lot of buildings up there. You know, we built the new Yankee Stadium. We just rebuilt Madison.
You did. You built the new Yankee Stadium.
I don't know
if you know that. That's a big deal. Do you know that?
It was a good-sized project. It was over $1 billion, and it was a huge project, and it has really worked out well.
Yeah, no, you know what? I don't like it, but the old stadium, and I know you've certainly been there, yes?
Yep. Absolutely. Saw Mickey Mantle there.
Ah. God, the old stadium was built vertically, and it was right on, I mean, and when that place got crazy, because it was built more vertically, that the noise, really an incredible place. And it was
the noise and the facade and right. the outfield. You remember right. before they fenced it off, but the, you right. had the monuments out there. You yeah. could hit the ball behind the monuments. My yeah. God.
And there's pictures of outfielders either jumping through the monuments to get at a ball or yeah. running around them. But the but it was this asymmetrical place, and but it was cavernous in terms of the way it was built. And now the new stadium's a little bit more, you know, a little bit more prototypical in terms of it moves horizontally as well as vertically. It doesn't have that, to me, same intimidating cavernous
yeah,
type
feel.
And every
sports venue right. nowadays has skyboxes, and they got all that kind of stuff. It's changed the dynamics of the design, and it's a different world, you know.
No, I know that, but it was its magic. You know what I mean? I realize it didn't have that, and now you have to space.
And we used to have fun playing Boston. You had something to do with the Boston team, didn't you?
I remember the first time I was ever in Yankee Stadium. I was a first lieutenant in the Marine Corps. I had been in the Marine Corps for, I want to say, 3 years, and back then, if you were came in with a reserve commission, you applied to be augmented, but
right.
you couldn't at that time you couldn't stay in your MOS. You were getting lat right. moved, and so they sent me to supply school, and that's right. So I went through the ground supply officer course with a whole bunch of other angry first lieutenants at the time, because we all, out of artillery, out of the grunts, out of the combat engineers, all these combat arms MOSs into support MOSs.
All one infantry.
And so I flew up to Yankee Stadium because the Red Sox, my dad was with the Red Sox, they're playing the Yankees. He said, you got to fly up. You got to see this. I said, okay. So I fly in Friday. I hop on the subway, and I'm in my Charlies, because, you know, if you fly in your uniform, people are nicer to you, and so, especially if you have an issue, so,
And particularly in New York, too.
Well, exactly, and so I get to Yankee Stadium, I get out of the cab at the airport, at the stadium itself, I walk up to the door, and a cop looks at me, and he says, your dad told me you were coming. And he said, he sticks his hands
no.
out, and he introduces himself, and used to be a 82nd Airborne guy. And so they open the door, and I walk in, and then the Red Sox clubhouse guy was there, so he sees me, goes, hey, Mike, how are you doing? Because I knew him. Throw my stuff in my dad's office, and then my ticket's on his desk. I go sit down, and I'm just watching the game. I'm sitting there by myself, and I'm sitting, like, right on the wall, probably to the if you're looking at from behind the visitor dugout, I'm sitting on the left hand side, right on the wall. So the Yankees go ahead in like the sixth inning, and then but I'm not standing and cheering. I don't stand and cheer for the Red Sox either, because I know where I am.
And all of a sudden, you get stoned.
Right. So all of a sudden, when the Yankees score and I don't stand, a hot dog wrapper goes flying over my head, and I hear, yo, skinhead, you don't like the Yanks. And I didn't move. I didn't move. But the game ended. I go down, and this is the old stadium, right, with all of its beauty. And and then underneath, though, it's like this is where they used to go. This is where Lou Gehrig went, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And so I asked my dad, I said, can we go see the monuments now? And he says, are you out of your mind? I have to talk to reporters, and then I'm going to change, and then we're going downtown to eat and have a drink. I'm like, come on. He goes, no, we're not going to go see the monuments. What are you, nuts? We'll see them tomorrow. Hey, they'll be there tomorrow. So then we went out. We went to downtown, and I'd never been in Manhattan, and went down and had a very nice dinner and whatnot. But my first experience with the old Yankee Stadium. And they were in first and second place, as is the case as many years, and sold out, and the hate in the building is just through the roof. It was awesome. It was awesome. Wow.
Well, one of my wife's cousins is a vice president with Turner now, but he was one of the executives running Yankee Stadium job. And if you remember when they were building the new Yankee Stadium, one of the workers buried a Red Sox jersey in the concrete. and they had to chop it out. And his picture was on the front page of the Daily News, leading the gang of construction workers chopping out the concrete to get the Red Sox jersey out of the concrete.
How about that? That's how deep the hate is, honestly, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They would have torn the building down to get that jersey.
Exactly. That is not going in the foundation of this building, okay? It's simply not going to happen. That is hilarious. When you look back on your career, what are some of the coolest projects? Give me two cool projects that you've been a part of. Yankee Stadium would be there. And Madison Square Garden, historic venue.
Yeah, but in my own personal career, I'd been out of the Marine Corps back with Turner about 4 or 5 years, and I became a project manager. My first project, and it was a rehabilitation hospital up at White Plains. Interestingly enough, not unlike what the rehabilitation hospital is at Walter Reed. And so that was the first job I ran myself, and, I was the number one guy on the job, and it was a great job, and it came in under budget and had a schedule. But you put together a team of guys just like you do in the Marine Corps when you go to some godforsaken place, and you go do it. But then we got building high-rise buildings, 40, 50, 60, 70-story buildings. We did a couple of 50-story buildings in Kaohsiung, Taiwan, and then we ultimately built a 100-story building there, and later on built a 105-story building. And that was pretty amazing, putting together the team. We even went down to Colombo, Sri Lanka, and built two 40-story buildings.
Wow.
So you're building it with subcontractors from that part of the world, but you're building it with labor from that area of the world. And then we built the Kuwait government headquarters, which during the first Gulf War, we were building it, and Kuwait was invaded. And I went from building a $1 billion project in Kuwait to having 26, 27 of my staff held hostage over there. We eventually got them all out.
How'd you get them out?
Every way you can imagine, going through Canadian embassies, stuff like that. I had guys, local staff, Kuwaitis, taking our people through the desert in desert vehicles while it was occupied, every way you can imagine. And we actually had staff over there in Kuwait that were held hostage, and we had their kids in high school back here in the U.S. that we ended up having to take care of till we got them out of the country. But we got everyone out safe, even got the project manager's parrot out of the country.
Well,
and
you can't
we went
leave
back
the parrot.
And started the job as soon as the first Gulf War was over, and built it with the original contractors under the original contract. And the Kuwait government later told us if we hadn't come in and pushed them into it, they probably would have never restarted the project. And it ended up being a couple $1 billion Kuwait government headquarters, the Amiri Dewan.
Wow. Well, did you have any kind of background in construction when you went to Turner?
When I went to college, I went to RPI up in Troy, New York,
right.
And I graduated as civil engineer, but I got to be careful to tell you I've never engineered anything in my life. In fact, my wife doesn't even believe I'm an engineer. But I went in the Marine Corps and was in combat engineers, and then went for a shore party in Vietnam, attached to 5th Marines. And then when I got back, I had been going to work for Turner, but I had a commitment to the Marine Corps, and I ended up spending 4.5 years active duty. I got back from Vietnam and went back with him, and, did stuff in the office, but mostly ended up in the field running projects. And I loved it because, it's the similarities with the Marine Corps is unbelievable because you put together a team of people, you figure out how you're going to get started, you figure out where your supplies are coming from, you get it all organized, you go do it. When the job's done, that team disbands, and you all go to other projects. And in the course of a career, because I spent over 50 years with Turner, you end up running across these guys and gals again and again. But it's always a unique project. And I spent 5 years in San Francisco building projects, spent probably 10 years in New York building projects around Westchester County and Long Island and a little bit of Manhattan. Ended up renovating the Chrysler Building in New York City.
Wow.
In the late 70s. And that was a story unto itself.
It must be very cool from a historical perspective. you know, you pull out old plans and then
I'll tell you a quick story. We found the original set of drawings for the Chrysler Building, and if you looked at New York City at nighttime in the last 30 years, the top of the building is lit up at night.
Right.
But it had never been installed when the Chrysler Building was built in the 30s, and we found the drawings, and in 1978, we actually went up and installed all the fluorescent lighting on the top of the building, and so now you have the Chrysler Building with lights on, and then the Empire State Building did something similar.
Right.
But it had been planned in the 30s, but never built due to the economy.
Wow.
And I love Chrysler that. Building is a phenomenal building to walk through. The lobby is as wonderful as any building in New York.
So, they're almost, I don't want to say museums, but, you know, when you design something like that, that's so grand, back in the day, I mean, it was designed to be majestic is the right word?
Yeah.
It was designed to...
majestic is probably not the right word, right. But it was designed as much to be an artistic monument as anything else. But it also was a functional office building. When we got involved in it, the Walter Chrysler's old offices were actually in the building. They ended up stripping the stuff out of it and so on and so forth and converting it into office space. And they had a restaurant on the top of the building, which had been closed since the early 70s. But it was spectacular. Spectacular restaurant.
Right.
And so, you know, you get into the history and you get to learn how. And keep in mind, the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building were built during the Depression.
Right.
You see pictures of those iron workers working on those buildings.
No kidding.
It takes your breath away.
When you see those pictures of them up there sitting and having lunch.
Yeah.
Doing the ribboning
and
they're
drinking
doing.
Beer,
yeah.
And most of them were Mohegan Indians.
Why?
For some reason, Mohegan Indians got into the iron workers in New York City early on. They, for some reason, which I've never quite figured out, had no fear of heights. And I, even in the 70s and later on, when we had the iron worker union, a big percentage would be Mohegan Indians. And they were tough as nails. A hell of a lot of them had been in the military. And, they'd show up in the morning with a giant hangover, could barely lace their boots. And end up walking steel.
The interesting
guys.
Interesting. My guest this morning, Bob Nielsen, and we're talking very unexpectedly about construction and Bob's experience. I want to ask you before we talk about before you give us an update. I want to talk about doing construction in San Francisco. San Francisco, an interesting seismic little event. Because of the earthquake, San Francisco was destroyed. I want to say in 1906 by an incredible earthquake. And my grandmother, her mother was living there, and on her coffee table, she had this set of grapes, glass grapes that were melted. Half of it was melted, and it was from this fire that engulfed her mother's home during the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. And what's it like doing construction there? Because, and I'll tell you, you talk about my favorite cities in the world, Hong Kong, San Francisco, New York City. Not in that order. New York City, number one.
You've got the same three I got.
But they're very similar. They're international cities. They have concentrated downtowns, great food, absolutely beautiful in terms of being built either on the water, well, all three of them right on the water. And a ton of fun to go visit, and all three of them speak English. So it's fun. What's it like to do construction in San Francisco?
Well, the big difference for me for San Francisco, we were doing some office buildings downtown and a post office south of San Francisco, is in New York, particularly in Manhattan, you're building on a rock. So you got to blow out the rock for your foundation. In San Francisco, you're essentially building on what amounts to jello. It's a very, very soft soil, your clay, and your foundations are considerably different. You end up with caisson foundations and piling foundations that are totally different from New York. In fact, the old brick buildings in downtown San Francisco are great to a great extent. Were built on great big wooden rafts of redwood. and they would sink this one raft into the mud and build on the building on that.
Wow.
So it's a totally different type of construction. And yet, you know, you look around San Francisco, you got 50, 60 story buildings up there. Yeah. Bank of America was one of the first big ones.
Right.
And they're amazing. They're incredible. But the buildings in the 60s and 70s, they were the first to take on seismic design and really, really pay attention to seismic design. That since has spread to a lot of other areas, because as we know, even Washington, D.C. had an earthquake a few years ago.
Right.
Nobody's immune to it. But the seismic design, you know, 12 buildings are designed to be flexible. You might get 18 inches of movement in the top of a tall building. And so while they look rock solid, the main thing is that they're designed to be flexible and deal with the forces and stresses of earthquakes and things like that.
That I find,
in a way,
I
San
find,
Francisco's become a cutting edge for, you know,
seismic,
structural design.
Yeah, seismic engineering. Well,
yeah.
To me, it's amazing when, you know, you'll see some kind of seismic event, and somebody will have, you know, they'll go to a downtown camera, and you'll see the building swaying. And you look at it, and you're like,
yeah.
Oh, my God. And there was no structural damage to it. And you think, wow,
exactly.
It's designed
to be flexible.
That thing has that much flexibility designed in it. It's absolutely amazing.
Built the Burj in Dubai now, which is 160 stories, and that's probably got over 2 foot of movement at the top.
Holy smokes. I have an email question for you. Hey, Mac, I'm curious. I had this thought. Forgive me for bringing it up, but I'm curious. When the aircraft impacted the World Trade Towers in 2001, did Bob know what was going to happen? Did you have any idea that those buildings would come down?
I had not a clue.
Okay.
And a good friend of mine who's a well-known structural engineer did a lot of investigation on it. I don't think anybody in the country could have pointed out that they're going to come down the way they did come down.
Right.
But keep in mind, one of the issues was that building was never designed to have a plane half-loaded with jet fuel explode inside the building.
Right.
So you've got a totally different event taking place than anything that would have ever been considered for the design.
Right.
That building had been designed for storms and earthquakes and all that kind of stuff. So when you've got, I don't know how many gallons of jet fuel exploding, you got a different situation. Plus, when the World Trade Center was designed, you know, in those early days, they were still using asbestos and stuff like that to protect the steel.
Right.
And one of the problems with cleaning up the mess, and Turner Construction helped some other contractors in New York to clean up that mess, was it was all laced with asbestos. And many of the first responders and the workers that worked on cleaning up the World Trade Center have had lung problems and issues like that. But I don't think, honestly, anybody would have anticipated that kind of an explosion because, you know, a plane hit the Empire State Building in the 30s, a propeller-driven plane,
right,
and made relatively little damage, but not a jet plane going several hundred miles an hour.
Right.
That's a different story. I mean, in effect, you put a giant IED bomb right in the middle of the building.
That's traveling at a high rate of speed.
Yeah, and then all that fuel, as it's exploding and burning, is running down elevator shafts and stairwells.
Right.
So you've got a lethal combination.
Right, right.
As we've all learned.
Right, right. What another email. Hey, Mac, I found this conversation interesting about construction. Where's the most interesting/challenging place that Bob has ever worked in? So you mentioned San Francisco buildings on redwood, or seeing at least a plan
for it. In the old days. Redwood foundations, yeah.
Well, talk to me.
You would sink mats of redwood, 6, 8, 10 foot thick, into the mud and build the building on that.
It's amazing. Talk to me. What's the most challenging place you've ever worked in terms of either?
Well, we built 2 40-story buildings in the 90s in Colombo, Sri Lanka. If you remember, there was a little event going on, a fight with the Tamils, who were the rebels. and the Tamils were fighting the Sri Lankan military, and the Tamils succeeded in blowing off bombs outside of our buildings when they were about 85% complete twice. And my project manager called me one day, a bomb had just gone off, and he'd been in his office on, I don't know, the fifth or sixth floor, and all the glass was blown out. And I think it was about 9 months later that it happened again, and he called me again, and he said, Bob, that's it, I'm goddamn retiring, get the hell out of here. And amazingly, we had had the owner, we had bought insurance to cover these kinds of events, which the owner didn't want to pay for. Well, he was very happy to pay for the insurance because we got the glass replaced. But it was the challenge of building in a country that wasn't used to this kind of technology and buildings. And you were putting 21st century designs into a country that was living the way people lived 100 years ago. The department stores downtown were like English department stores from the 1880s. You know, there wasn't even air conditioning. The phone systems, cell phones, were just coming out when we were building in Colombo, Sri Lanka in the 90s. And they went from a phone system where you had to wait 4 years to get a phone in your office to instantaneously, in a matter of months, having a wireless phone system that works for the whole country. So, you know, you got all the it's not unlike you guys fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. You're bringing in 21st century technology in some cases, 15th century society. And, you know, there's Afghanis that are seeing you guys calling drones and airplanes and shit they've never seen an airplane except the 30,000 feet.
Right.
So you've got to, but one of the keys, Michael, is you got to learn their culture and understand their culture. And I don't mean just learn a language because I don't speak any languages. I don't even speak English very well. But you got to learn the culture of what's going on in those countries to really understand and work with them. And it's the same shit you did in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, you had a good training ground, Vietnam, right, that prepared you to, if you were going to be effective, you had to learn
absolutely
the culture, right?
I looked at the Marine Corps as my equivalent of a master's degree. Instead of screwing around with a master's degree in college, I got in the Marine Corps in Vietnam, and you learn how to work with people.
All right.
And
that's a nice transition
to me is what they do.
That's a nice transition to give us an update on what's going on with 100 entrepreneurs, because I think that little segue in terms of veterans in construction, veterans in trades, it is very, very similar to handling your squad, your team that you experience in the military.
Your fire team, your platoon, your company.
And you have
all the same thing.
And you have a master's degree in that.
Well, no, I got a master's degree in Vietnam.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, Marines, veterans don't.
I signed up for an MBA at NYU, and I quit after a year because the professor had his head up his ass.
But most veterans don't know that. That experience at such a young age is really an anomaly.
Exactly. Well, one of the things I found when as you know, I've been going over Walter Reed and Bethesda Naval Hospital for the last 15 plus years. And one of the things I did was I approached Turner Management and I said, you know, we got some amputees over here. We're going to try and help them go to school, but I'd really like to hire some because I think these guys got their shit together. And while they were in the in combat in Iraq initially and then later Afghanistan, they learned a whole lot, and I think they'd be great. And fortunately, the president and CEO of Turner, Peter Davern, and Nick Bellotti, the guy running Turner International, both of their dads had been in the Marine Corps during World War II. And Peter Davern at one point told me, he said, try to give me five a year and we'll see what happens. But I looked at the wounded vets and I didn't really give a shit whether they were Army, Marine Corps, whatever. But I looked at the wounded vets, all male or female. I looked at them and said, you know, this stint they've done in the military, whether it be 3, 4, 7, 12, 14, or 20 years, has given them the equivalent of an MBA in how to get things done in the world. Not business, not finance, but how do you really get shit done? And I said, these guys, I think, would be great candidates for Turner. And I ended up, over a period of time, probably getting 30 or 40 jobs with Turner or with our owners or our subcontractors. And in the early parts of the war, I was mostly dealing with amputees. And I was actually able, because we built the amputee center at the old Walter Reed, and then we built the NICO center, the brain injury center at the new Walter Reed, I was actually able to get vets while still in the military, still in rehab, come work for us as unpaid interns. And it showed me that you didn't need an engineering or architectural degree per se. You needed the things that the military teach you, which is how to walk and chew gum at the same time and how to goddamn listen and how to be, if you're supposed to be to work at 8 in the morning, you show up at 7 and you got the day planned out before work starts, not at 11 o'clock in the morning, and basically get shit together and get things done. And the kids that we've had come in to work for us have ranged, you know, from guys with 20-something years in the military to guys with 4 years. But they were all veterans, and they were all kinds of combat veterans, not just grunts. Right. But they knew how to get a job done. They knew when you put them someplace how to go make it work. And several of them have come back and worked initially as interns and then worked with Turner as a staff. And then also return to college. They either get a, you know, construction management degree or an engineering degree or things like that. We've got an estimator in Denver right now, Matt Parker, who lost both his legs above the knee, was really in tough shape when he got to Walter Reed. His girlfriend from high school came back and helped him. He actually got married in the old Walter Reed Matsy, the amputee center. And didn't know what he was going to do, and I kept talking to him and talking to him. He went back to Colorado and New Mexico and went to junior college, and I said, listen, I'll get you a part-time job working with Turner as an intern. But right now, today, he's married, two kids, and he's a senior estimator in the Denver office. He helped work on the Denver VA project with us. A great, great success story. And this kid can do anything. And, you know, he found in a role with Turner an opportunity that paralleled the things that he was doing in the military. But, of course, that was cut short when he got blown up.
Right.
And it was interesting because through a friend of mine, I got introduced to Spider Nylon and went up and had a meeting with him when he was the ACMAC at the Pentagon and said, we're not going to try and take anybody from the Marine Corps that wants to stay in, and I want you to know that. But what we're going to do is create opportunities where there's options. So if a kid comes back and has lost a leg or an arm and decides he can't do the things that he wants to in the Marine Corps, we'll create an opportunity for him. And Spider Nylon was all for it. He said, as long as you help steal our people, and, you know, that was never the intent. It was to give an option. And part of it was you give an opportunity to keep that vet busy so he's not sitting at home on the couch twiddling his thumbs saying, well, it's 11 o'clock, I'll have my first beer now while I'm watching TV.
Yeah, because
you keep the mind occupied, you keep them busy, and something they can put their heart and soul into. And, well, you know, it's what we've been talking about for the last year and a half or year. Post-traumatic growth. How do you get something to occupy that void in the head that makes them want to hop out of bed first thing in the morning and go get something done? You know, the guys at Bouldercrest talk about this all the time. Josh, I guess it is.
Josh.
And the guy that founded it. But you're creating something in there that replaces what they had when they were in the military, because they were in love with the military.
Right.
Now, most of them were so goddamn gung-ho, it's unbelievable. But you got to fill that void, because that opportunity isn't there anymore.
You know, my guest, Bob Nielsen, this morning, he of 100 Entrepreneur fame, and anybody who's listened to All Marine Radio has certainly heard Bob. And so, you know, it's interesting, Bob, that, you know, a lot of guys would not look at construction and say, well, I don't have any background in engineering or construction, so that wouldn't be for me. And your message.
Yeah, and a lot of them, Michael, think I'm looking for somebody to go out with a hammer or a saw and put up 2x4s.
Right.
You know, we're looking for people to manage the team. Big difference.
So if I say, do you have a background in construction, engineering? He looks at me and says, no. Can you run a team of guys?
Yeah, I'm looking for a background in common sense.
I could do that.
And, you know, somebody that's gone, you'd be perfect. Somebody that can do that. I mean,
common sense, complex problem solving, and being able to handle people.
And handle a team of people, get the laggards to get off their ass and get moving, and then pick out the gung-ho ones and help them lead the project with you.
Right.
It's using your brains and your common sense and being able to interact with people. One of the problems we had when computers took over the education process for engineers is engineers thought they could do everything by computer. They forgot that they had to talk to people. Well, the military, you've got to be able to talk to people. And we've had great success with it. Back in Vietnam when my fraternity brother came back and he was an engineer at RPI like me but didn't know what he was going to do, and I brought him into Turner. Nobody was hiring in Vietnam vets, and they grabbed him in a heartbeat.
Right.
And he spent a career, Kenny Wilson, down the Cincinnati office and ended up as a vice president and was fabulous because he knew how to get a team of people to go do something.
Okay, so how many people are you looking for, and how do people get a hold of you if they're interested? Because what you're talking about, the two things you're talking about, which you and I spoke of, are really what this whole program and why you and I have kind of found this chemistry together is. It deals with two things. One, this concept of post-traumatic growth. I think when you hear it, and the story I tell is I heard General Mattis, I was watching something and General Mattis was speaking.
Right.
And he, all of a sudden he drops this, I prefer to look at it as post-traumatic growth. And I remember thinking, what is that? I've never heard that. Like, what did you say? And he said, look, there's two ways you can deal with an experience like that. One is you can be disabled by that. He said, and I think sometimes we're maybe too quick to think that that is the default path for the experience.
Or give them drugs.
Right. He said, but it's not. He said, there's millions of Americans that fought in World War II, fought in World War I, that came home and used that as a springboard to go to a better place in life and take the country with them. And he said, and so, you know, he said, I prefer to look at it, you know, in that vein, to use it as a springboard. And so the concept of post-traumatic growth, and you mentioned Ken Falk and Josh Goldberg, those guys are out in front of this, you know, in terms
and
of...
They get it.
Right,
they
and
understand.
So, and then if you marry that concept up with, you know, a career in with a company like Turner, you're giving somebody their life back again. You're showing people the way, and then hopefully, you know, if you can clone this thing, and show other corporations that you can find great employees, I can show you where.
Absolutely right. I mean, traditionally, Turner goes out every spring. And they conduct interviews at college, and now they are up where they hire 400 or 500 a year from college. And traditionally, we've looked at architects and engineers. I mean, back in the 50s, that's exclusively what we looked at. We eventually expanded. We began to look at MBA people. But in the last 15 years or so, while this war has been going on, we've had a lot of success bringing veterans into the company and creating career opportunities for them and help them, because of the skills and the ingrained training they've gotten in the military, they make great career employees to run construction projects. And that's what we do. We run construction projects. We do 13, 14 billion a year now in construction projects. We're the largest builder in the U.S. and one of the largest worldwide. So the people that we look at from that military background is a very, very positive thing for us. So Monday I was up in New York and I was meeting Peter Davern, who's the president and CEO, and Nick Bilotti, who ran Turner International. And I was updating him on what we do with 100 entrepreneurs, because 100 entrepreneurs really tries to help vets and their wives and caregivers start businesses.
Right.
And Peter Davern looks at me and he said, Bob, I got a favor I want to ask you. He said, we're looking to get 400 or 500 employees, new career employees this year. I'd like you to get 40 or 50 from the military. And, of course, my immediate answer was, sure, I'll be happy to. Let me figure out a way to do it. And the thinking is, because of all of the qualities and strengths that I see in veterans and you see, Michael, and the gunner sees, and what they've picked up and learned, being able to, the priority is no longer you, it's the team. These are great skills for what we want. So what I thought about and then I discussed with you is, why not mention this on All Marine Radio? And initially, I'm going to suggest people put together one-page resume, no more than one page, because I don't know anybody that can read more than half a page. To put together a one-page resume, but equally important, you've got to have a cover note with it, of two paragraphs that says what I have done, where I can go into Timbuktu and put together a team and accomplish something. And I'm preferring veterans that have been in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't give a shit what branch of service or male or female or anything like that. And I don't particularly care whether you've got super duper awards and decorations. I want to know in that one or two paragraphs where you went and accomplished the project, and I don't care if it was running a water purification unit or a command and control center or an FO team for an artillery unit, what you were able to do and what you were able to accomplish and how you did that. And that's the kind of things we're looking at. And initially what I want them to do is email this stuff to me. My email is robertnlikenancy802@mac.com. I'll do the initial look through and then I'll pass them on to the president's office in Turner. Alternatively, they can go to the website, the Turner Construction website, and there's a section where you can apply for a job. I looked at it this morning and I haven't applied for a job in a long time and it looked more complicated than doing my goddamn income taxes. But get a one-page resume to me and a one-pager with a couple of paragraphs on why I think I can make a team work and what I've done. And that's the kind of thing we're looking for. And I'm not guaranteeing that everybody that sends it in to me is going to get a job, but at least I can get it into the hopper with the right people paying attention. And I've got a commitment from a guy who his word is his bond. We're going to try to get 40 or 50 veterans to come aboard this year. And to me, this is a huge step in making that transition with a goal built in and a certain amount of career opportunity that you can get your arms around. And the pay's not bad. But once again, the pay's not the goddamn issue. It's getting this kind of a job and the opportunity.
Right.
The other thing that's good and important here, Michael, is because we have so many veterans in Turner, most of the Vietnam veterans are like me now, they're retired, but we have so many there's veterans in Turner that can help each other. They can talk to each other.
Right.
I just put a couple of veterans, or a veteran yesterday working in the Texas office in touch with Travis Green, because as you know, you and I know Travis, he's an amazing Marine EOD guy that designed a prosthetic foot and is now manufacturing it in Texas. I want one vet talking to another vet to see how they can help each other.
Right.
So So it's this kind of an approach, and I think, and we don't, I don't like bullshit job fairs and stuff like that where, you know, a bunch of retired colonels show up and say, shake your hand, and, oh, yeah, we get a pile of resumes. This is a different situation. It's where we are creating opportunities for veterans to come in and be part of a team and learn from other guys that have been through and gals similar experiences.
All right. And then, you know, in our conversation, just so people know, what's exciting, I think Bob and I both think, is that, you know, we can take something like this and we can go to another company and say, hey, we want to give you a couple references. Call these guys right. And talk to them about the quality of employee they got out of this partnership with us. And we'd like to enter into a partnership with you to deliver 10% of your workforce from veterans. And we will maintain this. They'll be your top performers.
And one of the things that you and I talked about is I'd like to get some veterans that are working for Turner right now or recently retired, right. Like Matt Parker out in Denver, the double amputee, and let him talk to you. Let him, you know, you interview him and talk to him. And he's a one hell of a great vet. But he's a great Turner employee. Or we had a guy named Pat Murray who lost a leg and his hands were burned. And I got him out of Walter Reed. His whole goal in life is to go back to Providence, Rhode Island to be a fireman. And I got him on Turner, a job with Turner when we were building the Fort Belvoir Hospital. And he was on there from beginning to end. And he's gone off and gotten a master's degree somewhere and stuff. But, you know, fabulous examples of what you can do in making this transition.
All right.
It's creating a sense of opportunities, and it's different than just holding a job fair and 500 corporations that are defense contractors show up looking for resumes so they can get vets that they can hang out on Memorial Day. This is different. This is making a career that's every bit as goddamn important as what they were going to be doing for the rest of their career in the military.
What's Matt's
name? You know, I know, Michael, that if you or the gunner send me a name with a resume, it's worth paying attention to.
Right.
Because these are men and women that you know that can do it.
No, and that we've seen do it. They're ballers. Tell me, what's Matt's last name? What's Matt's last name?
I listen to you interview these guys, and they're unbelievable. I want to call them up and say, come on in.
Well, I learned it in the Marine Corps, and then I practiced it in the civilian world. The single most important thing you do for your organization is control who comes into it. Because
Absolutely. It's
a lot easier to bring really good people into it than it is to get bad people out of it. And so you have to ruthlessly fight the S1 to make sure he doesn't send you or she doesn't send you idiots, right? And you get good people. And we would look at the inbound list. All right. Let's all sit down. I think everybody has the rank of sergeant above. Who knows people on that list? I'm looking for idiots, and I'm looking for smart guys, one of the two.
And I don't want shitbirds.
Right.
The shitbirds will spread to other shitbirds.
Right. And then we'd identify the idiots, and then it was my job and the first sergeant's job to keep them out of the unit. You know, and then it was our job to fight for, hey, could, you know, and normally the good guys have reputations, other people want them. We just made sure that we were over there working that. And the same thing applies in the civilian world. If you wait for
Michael, look at your situation. You were back being a radio broadcaster and your buddies in the Marine Corps call you.
Right.
Say, we got a great opportunity. Fight the war.
Exactly. Exactly
like that, but pretty close.
Both of them have been on the last couple of weeks talking about, really, and I'll tell you what, for me it's a source of pride, my friends, because they're general officers now. But they're not afraid of the sunlight, and they both, the last couple of weeks, two of them have come on and talked about at length in very blunt ways, the whole online online behavior thing, where we are as an institution. And I'll tell you what, I don't think general officers do that enough. And we provide a forum for it.
We need to do more of it because we need that openness.
Because when you hear Kennedy yesterday, who's in charge of recruiting, saying that Kate Germano's criticism probably was valid when she made it. but it's not valid anymore. That's not how we do it anymore. And then you hear, you know, him talk about it. You say, okay, all right, we've got to solve this behavior issue, but it looks like the institution has responded to much of this criticism and is where it is very deliberately and continues to evolve it. But I feel better because I've heard these guys address these issues, and it's a good thing.
And, Michael, you hit a great point because they admitted that we better get to know and understand social media.
Right.
I learned something about social media while I've been dealing with wounded veterans for the last 15 years. I didn't know Facebook from the man to moon until I got going to Walter Reed and watched these young vets talk. But the vets were all talking to each other on Facebook and texting and doing stuff like this. And it was unbelievable. And, you know, I probably got 500 or 600 vets on my Facebook contact. Not all there all the time, but a bunch are listening and talking and communicating. Texting became the vehicle for communicating for guys with brain injury.
Right.
Now, it's like if you're in the, you know, part of the Marine Corps nowadays and you don't understand social media, it's like all of the kids coming in through Parris Island all speak Urdu. Well, if you don't understand Urdu, you ain't going to know what the hell's going on. So you've got to understand what social media is and how it works. It's the means of communications. And I learned so much from these young vets, 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, on how they use it and how they work with it.
Right.
I mean in a constructive means. And in terms of creating opportunities or frustrations with medical care or somebody in the VA giving them a runaround, and it's a goddamn useful tool.
Right.
We got to understand that.
If you look at it, and to me that's the way you look at it. Do you have to put up what you had for breakfast that day? No. Okay, but you ought to be proficient in the language so that you can understand it, you can operate
in it. Understand the strength of it and the power of it and the danger of it.
Right. No, but those guys, that's why this is good, but what you're doing and the link that you create, Bob, is incredibly important because you have a link into the business world. And like I said, I mean, if this can be the pilot project that Almarin Radio and 100 Entrepreneurs Project gets going, and then slowly but surely we can bring other corporate partners on so that we can get that number from 40 to 400 and then from 400 to 4,000 a year. You're changing lives.
I'm going to start reaching out for some vets in Turner, get them linked up with you so you can interview them.
What's Matt's last name and the guy in Denver?
Matt Parker. Matt Parker.
I want to interview. Will you get me his contact or will you talk to him
I'll get him. He and I talk every couple of 3 months right now, and he's a great, great representative, and he's tough as nails. He's got a wonderful wife, Nina, and two little kids. But he'll be great. And then I'm going to get this Vietnam buddy of mine, Kenny Wilson, to talk to you also, because he can tell you what a career in construction did after the Marine Corps. And I'll get some others lined up.
All right.
I
want to talk to Matt Parker.
Yeah, Matt will be great.
And no, I mean their stories are great, and to me the biggest bugaboo is construction. I'm not a construction guy. Oh yeah, you are. You just don't know it. And there's a career out there waiting for you.
Absolutely.
That with a great company, and well, what would I do? You'd manage people to get a job done. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, hell, I can do that. Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
All right. That's what they're looking for. Oh, well, yeah.
That's what we're aiming for.
Right.
And we'll work from our end on it, and I will get some good candidates to talk to you. And, of course, you know, I want to keep talking about it. And I think, you know, we share these ideas with Boulder Crest and people like that. Dog Tag Bakery in D.C. is just phenomenal. We had them do a presentation this week. They take a cohort of 12 vets or caregivers at a time, and they bring them in. They got a facility in Georgetown,
right.
part of the university. They teach them how to work in a bakery, but then they spend half the day with professors teaching them how to run a business.
Right. No.
And you get paid while you're going there.
No, the phenomenal. And you know, that's what have been one of the coolest things about All Marine Radio is you know, doing segments on places like, you know, Boulder Crest, Dog Tag Bakery, Foursquare up in Manhattan, Veterati, being an amplifier for all these great things that are out there that veterans can use, right? And
yes,
with emphasis on
exactly
the can.
Right.
Right? But again, the whole premise of post-traumatic growth is, yeah, that experience is not easy. Okay, but ever since Cain and Abel fought, people have been dealing with conflict and trying to get over it and trying to deal with it. Right? We are no strangers. We are just the latest, some of the latest people on the planet to experience that. That does not need to be a lifelong disability for you. You can use that as a springboard.
It's not a deficiency, it's a strength.
Right.
Post-traumatic growth.
Right.
You've been through some shit, and boy, you can handle anything now.
And let me tell you, and we don't own it, okay? First responders deal with it. Police deal with it.
Oh,
rape victims, assault victims, domestic violence victims, all those groups deal with it. We're certainly nothing special. We just experience it in combat. And so
the problem is, for years and years, we all made believe it didn't exist.
Right.
I think one of the great things out of this last 15 years is anybody up to the guys running the branches of services know it's there, know it's a real issue. And if you got a problem like this, you don't hide it.
Right.
Vice the Gunner even talks about it.
Well, you know what? I love that about my friends is they don't hide it. They talk about their struggles with it, both physically and mentally. And I think that helps all of us. That helps all of us. All right. Your task is to get deliver Matt Parker so I can have him on next Thursday. You can hop on with us and we'll talk about careers in construction and we'll continue our dialogue about post-traumatic growth.
Okay, he might do better talking by himself, but either way.
Okay, all right, whatever. I'm easy.
Great.
All right,
awesome,
sir.
Running.
No, you're doing great. You do great stuff there, Nielsen. I don't know where you came from or how you got there, but well, I do know some of that. But you continue to do great things, and you have the heart of a lion relative to helping veterans. And and God bless you and what you do. You certainly make the world a little bit better for all of us.
And we're making progress with 100 entrepreneurs, and we have more and more vets starting businesses. One vet this week is going into the candlestick making business. So,
I love that.
To be anything you want.
The candlestick business. No, as you said, that's the thing. You can, and it's people like Dog Tag Bakery. And in fact, it's interesting. I remember interviewing. There was a Marine got out as a Lance Corporal. He was there. He said, "Well, I don't know that I'm going to start a bakery, but the skills that I've learned here have taught me how to start a business." Not only how to start a bakery, and I thought that was awesome.
And he might not even start a business. He might be a good employee, but he's going to be a far better employee because he knows what it takes to make that business work.
Right, right.
You know, he's not just showing up to get a paycheck.
All right, Nielsen, give the 100 entrepreneurs. How do people find you on that website?
Look on the Facebook. Just Google 100 entrepreneurs. I gave you an updated link this morning, Michael, for the 100 Entrepreneurs thing on Facebook. And you can also Google 100 Entrepreneurs. We have a website. We got 120 or 130 videos of our classes. We also have podcasts where we interview entrepreneurs and how they started their business. So reach out for us. And like I said before, if you're interested in an opportunity with Turner, at least initially, send me an email, robertn802@mac.com, a one-page resume and a one-page, two-paragraph letter on why you think you can get shit done.
That's the way we do it.
Good description?
No, I like it. I like it. Whenever there's ever a little bit of profanity in it, it always makes me feel better. I know that's a human frailty, and it's probably a weakness, and the nuns would certainly frown on it that taught me when I was a kid, but... Sorry, I like it. All right, Nielsen, you have a great...
There's no censors out there.
You have a great day, and I will be in touch.
You too. Always enjoy talking. Take care. Semper Fi.
Yeah, Semper Fidelis. That is the one and only Bob Nielsen from of 100 Entrepreneurs fam. So, bottom line is this. Turner Construction is looking for people that can lead groups of people, people that know how to get things done, and people that know how to balance that together. Who does that sound like? And people that can work under stress with deadlines. Who does that sound like? So, pretty exciting day to announce that for us. Nielsen's great and providing a little bit of a platform to get the word out so that we could find people and then doing it, you know, with an emphasis on post-traumatic growth. Hey, look, we don't expect you to not come with baggage. We get it. And we know people that can help you get to a better place. So that's what we're doing here on All Marine Radio. So awesome day. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Chris Woodbridge. We're going to finish a discussion that was cut short by a little bit of a power issue yesterday. So sit back, relax. We'll continue our discussion here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.